sample that we got from France, from a group that we collaborate with. This graph shows the association between secondary symbionts and Bemisia biotypes in that was done in Israel by Elad Hill 2 years ago. And what he showed is that there is a very clear...
But I came up with something very interesting. So this is the life cycle of the, you know, typical life cycle of...
...been confined by areas or streets where most of Leishmaniasis cases are located. You can see. So first we conducted a survey of children, and a cluster survey was done by random sampling of human population. A total of 4,200 children from 1 to 14 years old are being tested by direct agglutination test on blood samples, and a questionnaire was developed for the purpose to determine VL risk factors and detect infected children by clinical signs. Two symptomatic children were found during our survey. You can see these children. Then four dogs, blood samples from 600 pet dogs and 620 stray dogs were tested using the RK39 dipstick test. According to our results,
the application, so we have about a 76% reduction in the mine leaves and about a 96 to 97% reduction in larvae infesting foliage and tubers in the cages at the end of the season. And in terms of these tubers were actually placed in the cages. We didn't get very high infestation in the ground. We didn't get a lot of ground cracking, so the larvae couldn't get there. Plus, I nicely provided them nice tubers at the top, so they probably didn't need to. But in terms of controlling tubers, our virus was as effective as Monitor, which is metamidafos. That's the chemical standard. So that was quite encouraging. Combination and reduced rate treatments in the yellow. The virus BT rotation was more effective than the BT alone, but the reduced rate virus treatments didn't seem to be as effective. And it seems that perhaps the rate here, 4 times 10 to the 12 occlusion bodies per acre, is perhaps the minimum rate which would be effective. Okay, the next part of the talk is the the storage part. Currently, there are no registered insecticides for potatoes in storage, so this is kind of an interesting approach. Basically, again, we pulverized the infected larvae, incorporated them with various dry carriers. So we tested sand and talc, kaolin, clay, and diatomaceous earth, and freeze-dried these formulations and used them to cover our tubers. And the two basic tests I'll describe. One is pre-treatment, where we treated our tubers before infestation, and also as a curative, where we looked at the efficacy against larvae that were already infesting the tubers. And there's a lot of data from this experiment. I'm just going to show you the data for the talc, which was the carrier. I should also point out, in case you're wondering, would people want talc in their tubers? We did the same experiment but with dipping, so that didn't leave a residue. But I think it's quite curious. If you look at the dosage in the second column here, this is larval equivalents per kilogram of tuber. So we're getting really quite excellent control all the way down as low as this rate, which equates to about one infected larvae per 100 kilos, which I think is way better than I expected. That is when the tubers were treated pre-infestation. Post-infestation, it's a different story, and even at our, this is a relatively high rate, we still weren't killing all our larvae. So it seems to me probably the best strategy would be to to prevent spread within storage. You know, you're not necessarily going to kill everything, but you're going to prevent any neonates that are spreading within a storage situation from surviving when they infest further tubers. And this is the same data for BT. It was produced in very much the same way, but with a, I think we used a, what was it we used? Deliver, was a waterborne powder formulation. And so the seems that about 38 milligrams per kilogram of tuber was the minimum rate you could get away with and get good control. Again, post-infestation, it was a lot lower. And so currently, there is actually a commercial product produced. It's marketed in Peru as a dry powder. It can be mixed in bags, as you can see in the picture here. It's been quite successful. And so just to conclude, I think our data were good. We got up to 97% control within one season for our virus treatments. There's definitely more work that needs to be done with regards to the scaling up and looking at some of the operational considerations that would need to be applied. And so in 2008, we hope to run further trials looking at larger plots, more realistic pest densities, and the same with the storage studies as well. And I'd just like to finish by mentioning some other work in our lab that Larry's involved with more than me, but there's also some work with a fungus, Muscador, which is a biofumigant. Is that the 10 minutes?
10 minutes.
Okay. And also with nematodes, which you've all heard about at this session. There's one interesting approach with the nematodes is to combine them with foliar desiccants, which a lot of the potato growers use late season to largely for tuber quality. And so if you could combine those two approaches, the larvae would have to leave the plant at the same time that nematodes would be available. So that might be an interesting approach. So I've got a little. Any questions?
Yeah, plenty of time for questions.
Ian. In the tubers. Well, they typically survive till the fourth instar before dying. They fail to pupate, so they would cause some localized damage within the tuber, and the length of time would depend on the incubation temperature. Yeah. Jared.
It seems there's a striking difference between your efficacy on a toted tuber versus the field, so there's probably a delivery issue in the field. Do you have some ideas as to how you're going to get better delivery as you get the similar coating you would have?
Right. Yeah.
Storage
conditions are very different, and I didn't go into that. They're way better for microbials. You don't have the sun and everything. So it wasn't surprising that it worked a lot better in storage than in the field. I don't know whether or not a dry carrier in the field is practical. Probably not. There's definitely some scope to look at UV protectants. And we've done some work with the codling moth virus with UV protectants, so that might be one approach to improve the field efficacy. Yeah.
You think it's UV that's mostly in the form of the field, so that's...
Oh, yeah. So I think our half-life studies were about 3.5 days. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's what you would expect. But that was an unprotected virus. Yeah. Thank you.
Other crops, ornamentals, and weedy plants. The larvae that feed on the roots do most of the serious damage. They can girdle major structural roots and facilitate infection by various plant pathogens, especially Phytophthora. So we often talk about the Phytophthora diprepes complex in Florida citrus. So it's a major citrus pest, can kill trees and destroy groves. And the estimate of annual losses in Florida is about $75 to $100 million. It's spread very easily on ornamentals. Gets into a lot of different ornamentals in Florida. Florida ships out a lot of ornamentals, nursery stock, in trucks and aircraft. And in that way, it was transmitted to the Mall of America at one point, found in their ornamentals, had to be wiped out there. Got into a botanical garden in Britain. That was kind of interesting. Recently introduced into Texas, southern Texas, a citrus area, and in California, another citrus area, where it's considered a major threat to agriculture, subject to quarantine eradication programs in both of these states at the moment. So diprepes is a serious pest, getting into a lot of different places, moving around. You'll hear a few other talks about it at the conference this week. And so we're still having problems with it in Florida as well. The life history, the adults spend a lot of time in the canopy, feeding on foliage and citrus, especially it's the young flush that they really like. They mate in the canopy and lay their egg masses in the canopy. The eggs can be laid in masses that can number about 350 eggs or less. When the female lays the egg, she actually seals the leaves together, two leaves together around that egg mass, so that protects them against various kinds of predators. But certain egg parasitoids can still get in and find them and parasitize them. When the larvae hatch, they're about a millimeter in length, and they drop down to the soil where they burrow in and start feeding on fine fibrous roots. As they get larger, they move into the larger roots, into the crown of the tree, and that's where they can really, really damage the tree. Pupation occurs in the soil, and about a year later, they'll emerge from the soil as adults, but sometimes shorter, sometimes longer. The life history can be quite variable. So what makes diaprepes difficult to control? Well, last count, there were 270 known crop, ornamental, and weedy plants that could be used as hosts for either for adult feeding, egg laying, or larval development, so they can get into a lot of different things. An asynchronous, complex, variable life history, highly dependent on soil temperature and moisture, so it's really tough to predict when they'll get peaks in the population. In central Florida, they can emerge almost any time during the year. High fecundity, protected egg masses. Many pesticides are really ineffective against soil-dwelling larvae, especially there's special restrictions in places like Florida with high water tables and so on, so that can be an issue. And many natural enemies have very limited patchy distributions, and this applies to sort of natural populations of entomopathogenic nematodes. Lots of different control strategies are being researched and used currently in Florida and other places. Biological control, cultural control, chemical control. Entomopathogenic nematodes are probably the best weapon we have against larvae in the soil. Historically, we've been using augmentation. Now we're looking more at conservation, and you'll see what that's all about as we go along. Focusing first on augmentation, various Steiner nematodes and heterobditids have been tested for control of root weevils and other citrus insects in Florida over the years. Commercial nematode products have been used by Florida citrus growers to control root weevils for over 15 years, so we have quite a history there. It's estimated that about 19,000 hectares of Florida citrus are treated annually with Steiner Nemo Real Brave, one of the best nematodes we've found for this at the moment, and Becker Underwood's product BioVector is one we use quite frequently in Florida. Nematode augmentation, well, here's Larry Duncan preparing a batch of BioVector on the tailgate of our truck, mixing it all up. You saw some of this with Joel's talk as well. Here we're adding it to a spray tank, and then we're essentially mixing it up and injecting it into the irrigation system. So here it's another chemigation system as well. So we're spraying it out under the trees using these microjet sprinklers under the trees through the irrigation system. So somewhat similar to what you saw with Joel's talk. In terms of monitoring the success of augmentations, we use these cage sentinel weevil larvae. We bury these in the soil, usually drilling a hole and burying them about 20 to 30 centimeters down. And so that's how we monitor a lot of our augmentation. We also monitor adult emergence in these cone traps, and we sort of monitor the adult population using what's called tetter's